Good evening, everyone. We're going to get started. It's a nice, intimate crowd on a Wednesday evening here at the Hirshhorn, and we're thrilled that you could come join us tonight. I'm Olga Vies. I'm the director of the Hirshhorn, and tonight we are hosting In Conversation with Art Angel. And this is the second event in our ongoing series of discussions that explore issues central to contemporary art. And tonight I'm pleased to welcome James Lingwood, who is the co-director of Art Angel. And James will be in conversation this evening with Ann Elgood, who's our associate curator here at the Hirshhorn. And they're going to focus tonight on the role of place in artistic practice, taking art out of conventional spaces like galleries and museums and moving the artists and the audience experience closer together. Based in London, Art Angel is really such a phenomenally important and special institution because of the way that it works with artists and partners with artists in facilitating the production and the creation of new work. And it truly is an art angel, I think, which inspires its name as an organization in terms of the way that it supports artists to find resources to make, I think, very ambitious works and working artistically with artists to enable them to grow and thrive and stretch their work often into new media or presenting their works in alternative contexts. As Art Angel's co-director and architect and an accomplished and inspired curator in his own right, James Lingwood is beloved and respected by so many for his great vision, but also because of his pioneering work with artists. James and Art Angel are responsible for some really wonderful projects that you're going to hear about tonight, including the very first project with Matthew Barney. The first Craymaster film grew from a partnership with Art Angel early on, and it led to really that the first in that important cycle of Matthew Barney's work. Projects that Art Angel has done has ranged from choral performances to film, and include Francis Alice's Seven Walks series, which is currently, part of it is currently on view here in our new black box space for new media, which you might have seen as you came in this evening. Ann Elgood, who's our associate curator here, has just completed her first year at the Hirshhorn, and she's really already had quite a significant hand in shaping and developing our contemporary program here. And as you pass through the lobby this evening, you might have gotten a glimpse of an upcoming project that is in process, our Directions project with Jim Lambie that will open next Friday on May 12th. And this is one of Anne's first exhibitions here at the Hirshhorn, part of the Directions series. And so we invite you to join us Friday night on the 12th from 8 to 11. We're going to have an art after hours evening with Jim Lambie, and he is going to be DJing that night in the opening, and there'll be some wonderful, I think, moments to experience his art in a large communal setting. Anne is also working on a project that will open this fall called The Uncertainty of Objects and Ideas, Recent Sculpture, which we're very excited about, that will open in October. So we invite you to sort of keep your eye on that coming in the fall. So I'm going to turn it over now to our two very talented curators, Ann Elgood and James Lingwood. Thank you.
Well, first I just want to say thank you to James Lingwood for agreeing to be here, and it's really an honor to have you. And I'm going to just explain the format for the evening, which, as you might tell from the way we're just casually sitting here, is meant to be sort of casual, and then say a few things about Art Angel and why I wanted James to come and speak with us. And then we'll start looking at art. The format will be that we've selected four artist projects that Art Angel has commissioned to focus on tonight, and they'll include Rachel White-Reed, Gregor Schneider, Jeremy Deller, and Francis Alice. And then we have a couple of backups. If we have time, we'll look also at a project by Kutluk Ataman and a project by Michael Landy. And James will get up and show images and sort of walk you through a little bit of the narrative of how these projects evolved and what the artworks are. And then I will pose some questions to him, but we also want you to interject at any point, really. So once you can interrupt James, you can interrupt me. Certainly at the point where I start asking him questions, please feel free to just shout out a question or raise your hand and I'll call on you so that it really becomes more of a dialogue. And with a nice small crowd tonight, I almost feel like making everyone move forward. But please feel free to do that, and I'll encourage you if you're not asking questions. So we really want it to be a bit of a back and forth. And we can also leave time at the end if there is any time. So we'll try to look at each project for about 15 minutes and see how it goes. So Olga already mentioned a few really important things about Art Angel and why we felt that in the context of this In Conversation series, which focuses on public art, Art Angel was the perfect organization to focus our attention on because of the way that they work with artists. And I think as institutional curators, in a way, I look to James and the projects that he does with a slight bit of envy because with each project, it's very malleable and there's a sense of adaptability that enters into everything that they do. So that if they're interested in an artist and want to work with them, the project can really grow and develop over time. And that may be a year or that may take 5 or 6 years before the project is realized. So there's a way, there's a more organic process which doesn't include a lot of deadlines. The project is sort of done when it's done and when the artist and the organization get to the point where they feel like it's ready to be presented. And I think that you'll see probably in some of James's remarks, and we'll get into this a little bit, how things really grow and develop and change. And there's room and space there for those changes to happen, which can be very rare when you're working with deadlines and institutional pressures. The other thing, of course, is the way that as commissions that happen primarily in the public, not always explicitly, but they are very much site-specific projects. And so this question of place enters into every project in a very meaningful way. And I think for artists today, particularly artists working in the public realm that we've been talking about in this series, of course, place is extremely important and integral part of all those projects. So that will come up again and again. And I think that ultimately what you'll see in the projects that Art Angel has done is that really the artists are expanding the very definition of what a public artwork might be or what we might conceive of as public, even as a definition. So that's something that we'll get into as well. So having said that, I think I'll turn it over to James, and we're going to first look at Rachel Whitereed's house.
Okay. Before
do
I
want to say more about
just
Art Angel?
Just firstly, thank you both very much for your introductions, which are very generous. The one thing that we're not is an institution, really. I like to think of Art Angel as being almost like an organism, which, as you said, changes shape and profile depending on the kind of work we're involved in. We're not very big on definitions. Words tend to get aimed at what we do. We have to do it ourselves, and the word public art still attaches in some way to the kind of work we do, but we tend to just think of these as being specific projects, which, in a sense, are not trying to conform to any pre-existing notion of what they should be. So rather than being, I guess the way that we're set up as an organization, it's a small office in London, is to try and maximize all of our resources and our energies outwards towards the project, so that towards the realization of the project into the world, not to try and sort of, as it were, suck it back in to make it conform in a way that somehow circumscribes its potential, as a specific project out there in the world. The idea of place, as both Olga and Anne have said, is absolutely fundamental to what we're interested in, and in a way, that still is a kind of counter tradition to the dominant tradition of Western art of the last centuries, actually. And, the dominant mode, as exemplified by, the museums I've been going around today in Washington, is one of a certain placelessness of art, which is predicated and based on an idea of its mobility, that it can move from one place to another, even from one culture to another. And so in a way, I guess the word that I'm quite fond of throwing out in these situations is the idea of entanglement. And I put that in contrast to the word autonomy. So autonomy is what, the high modernist idea of Clement Greenberg and whatever, is something which just stands on its own without reference to anything outside of it. And by contrast, I think some of the works which we've produced most successfully have become very entangled with a particular place or a particular context, almost so you can't necessarily separate the work itself from the world in which it is made. In a sense, its material is both what the artist has brought to the place and what the place has brought to the artist. Maybe we could have the lights down, please. These lights down, too. Can we have the lights down? I'm not sure he can hear me. Can we have the lights down?
He's working on it.
Thanks. So, in a way, it's not always really clear, particularly when a project that an artist brings to us actually begins. This is a photograph of a street in East London, Grove Road, in the late 19th century. Part of the East End of London has had a reputation of being a tough sort of working class enclave through most of the 20th century. But actually, when it was built, it was it was part of a thriving sort of economy moving out from the City of London. Anyway, by the time that we came across Grove Road, we being Rachel Whiteread and Art Angel, in the early 1990s, it had fallen on very hard times. This was just a row of terraced houses, many of which had been abandoned. And indeed, by the time that we started seriously to think about how we might realize the proposal that Whiteread had brought to me, which was very simply to make the cast of a house. This was the house in Grove Road that we lighted upon. And actually, it's quite interesting going to the National Gallery today and seeing the sculpture Ghost sitting there in the east wing, and just look. Such a classic, almost Egyptian kind of sculpture, but that was the work that I had seen in the East End in a tiny gallery about 2 years beforehand, and which really was the kind of basis on which the idea of moving from the cast of a room, which is what Ghost is, to the cast of a whole house in situ, how that all it emerged. So here we are again with we secured permission from the local council, not without huge difficulties, with the idea of making a temporary memorial. And then we had to work out a technique whereby we could actually make the cast from the mould of the house, working from the inside of the house outwards. And after 2 months of basically spraying concrete onto the existing interior walls and then leaving time for it to cure, we gradually took the house away from the mould, the roof, then the bricks, the doors, the features, etc., to reveal the imprint, the cast of the house. And there it is. The kind of strange thing about talking about this project now in the relative quiet of Washington is it's very hard to communicate just what a huge amount of noise such a quiet-looking, really mute, almost blind sculpture created in London. But it was probably the most contentious piece of art realized in London over the last 50 years or so. It inflamed opinion to a level which moved from the streets itself all the way to the House of Commons, where politicians of different persuasions all had their say as well. But of course, as I said, the one thing about this sculpture was that it's mute. It didn't really say anything specific to anybody. It was just a kind of receptacle into which people could pour their prejudices, their memories, their emotions. So I'm just going to take you on a little tour around the four sides of the house and make a couple of other observations. The first is that, unlike Ghost, which exists in a place of its own, in a museum, House existed in relation to all to several other different kinds of architecture. You see on the left there to the far left there's some 1950s housing blocks, and then just beyond that you'll see almost like the double of the house, similar kinds of 19th century terraced houses. From the back of the sculpture, you can actually see how small it was. I think although people described it as being a large monument, in actual fact, I thought it was kind of quite small and vulnerable. This is the amount of space in which most people live most of their time. So there's a kind of real sense of compression about it. But anyway, it was contrasted with these different forms of housing, say, particularly at the back there, the high-rise block, which was symptomatic of the attempts to relocate social housing from the terraces, which were then considered slums and to be dangerous and unhealthy, into these new kind of terraces in the sky. And from north to south, you would read House somehow in relation to this new business centre called Canary Wharf, which had been constructed in the late 80s and had come to symbolise the effects that Thatcherism and a new kind of global economy had wrought on the culture of the East End of London. So in a way, House tapped into all of these different kinds of possible readings without privileging one. Here's another one. To the right of House, you would see it in relation to a church. In fact, there were three churches of different kinds across the road. And I think several commentators said that it somehow suggested the way that the idea of home or the idea of domesticity had displaced religion in Britain as an organising agent of social stability. There's some quality British press for you. And actually, one sign of a sculpture, I mean, it's very, very rare of an artwork crossing the threshold from being something contained within our own culture, the kind of culture that we're all interested in, into a much broader culture, is when it starts to be the subject of cartoons. And House was very widely cartooned in this period, whilst it was being debated, in every possible part of London culture, from newspapers to television and radio, as I said, to sort of local and national politicians. It was always intended to be a temporary project. We felt that, firstly, we would never have got permission to have used the house and just left a monument there in perpetuity. But as the debate sort of raged on, there were quite a lot of there was quite a lot of pressure to extend its life. And in fact, we managed to extend its life for another couple of months or so. But it was then destroyed to the glee of the local councillors who'd been attritional since the moment it opened. It took about 3 months to build and a day to destroy. And it's still there. You can't see it anymore, but it's still there. To everyone who visited or experienced the work, somehow the place is charged by the presence of the sculpture. And I think one of the things that I feel quite strongly when people talk about the way that these projects are temporary, is that a problem, whatever, is that you have to trust in memory. And that I think the memories of most of the people who experienced this work were very strong and still attach themselves to the place, even if the sculpture is not visible anymore. So I'll leave it at that for the House.
I think my first question is if you could go into some more specifics about what the controversies were surrounding it. What were the criticisms of the piece? And conversely, what were the things that people felt really worked about it? And was there a split there in terms of, in your estimation, in terms of the general public's reaction to the work versus a more an art viewing public?
No, it was much more complex than that, and that was what made it really interesting. In fact, I should wind the reel back a bit, and just the reference to many people. There was a huge controversy in London in the early 1970s when the Tate Gallery bought one of Carl Andre's brick pieces. Equivalent, I can't remember which equivalent, but one of these simple rectangles of bricks. And, you know, for, I don't know what, £50,000. So there's a huge scandal about the amount of public money being spent on a pile of bricks and equally that it so clearly was devoid of any artistic merit to almost all the broader public. And the newspapers would do things like invite, you know, pay a local brick company to go and create their version of Carl Andre's bricks on the steps of the Tate, and you know, various strategies of this kind. Now, so what happened when House 20 years later arrived? And we'd been very quiet in our preparations. I mean, we did not have any pre-publicity about the project at all, because we kind of realized it was quite vulnerable whilst it was actually being made. So when it was unveiled or was there, the newspaper, I mean, there were two things. I mean, the cultural critics, the reviewers, were broadly speaking very sympathetic, and some of them immediately recognized the importance of the piece. But the popular press, the television and whatever, thought they had another Carl Andre-like controversy, which they could continue to, you know, to stoke up, really. But what they discovered was that, you know, so they dusted down their old battle plans of, you know, sort of cultural battles of, as you said, the general public against the art world elite, or the connoisseur against, you know, people who actually had more sense, you know. And what happened was that the contours of the controversy, as it were, completely eluded the kind of maps that they tried to design for it. So they kept on trying to say, well, okay, it's the local people who dislike it, and you know, the people from wealthier parts of London who are more sympathetic. But it was simply much more complicated than that. So whenever you could identify a block of opinion, it was people on the street, people in the local community, people in the broader community, you would find that there were differences between within that community, not between one community and another. And that made it much too complicated for the press to really stereotype. And so in that sense, I think it was a cultural watershed in London, because it persuaded people that projects which... Actually, the form of this work is relatively conventional, but nonetheless, it was considered to be an extremely radical work of its time. That projects like this had the capacity to generate responses amongst a much broader constituency of people, rather than, you know, a particular elite.
Was it in part really? I know that when you've started working with Rachel, the piece could have happened anywhere in the city. It was more a logistical question of finding the right site. So when it ended up on Grove Road, did that particular neighborhood, that street even, generate some of the controversy around it?
Well, I think whichever street... So we're getting some strange feedback. Whichever street it would have been located in...
It would have happened.
It would have
so generated... So it wasn't that actual community?
What happened was that we had to secure permission from the local council, who was headed up by a councillor who, although he was a liberal democrat, a liberal, was actually also a proto-fascist. And he was a demagogue. And he was absolutely enraged that we managed to secure permission over his head, that there were, I mean, there was a small local group of seven, of whom four voted to give Art Angel permission to make this sculpture for 3 months. Three voted against. He was away when this vote went through. And when he came back, he made it his, I think he felt there was an opportunity for him to generate, a sort of local firestorm which would benefit him politically. You know, he had a very kind of a small but nasty vision of what the sculpture could do for him. But there's maybe a broader point, which is when you're working in outside of the more protected zone of a museum or a gallery, that these kinds of projects are in a much more volatile situation. And there are many things that you cannot predict and you cannot control. And these contingencies are what I think makes it potentially such a kind of charged and interesting way of working. There were political contingencies, contingencies of what else was happening in that particular part of East London at that particular time, which we hadn't, you could not have designed some of these kind of relationships. But the sculpture somehow, or an interesting project of this kind, creates a kind of magnetic field around it, which sort of then has all of these different issues flying around.
Do you think that with the amount of publicity it got, that that has had an impact on public art in general in London, that it sort of set a stage in some ways to allow to push it, to allow Art Angel to push it, but even other organizations, that people were part of the conversation now, that the public was engaged?
Well, I think the tendency is, generally speaking, for projects of a particular kind of visibility like this, it's not easy. The tendency is still for people to find reasons to say no. Mm-hmm. Most more permanent public sculpture in London, there are very few notable examples. Most of it is still relatively anonymous. Mm-hmm. In fact, there's a wonderful quote by the Austrian writer Robert Musil, who said that, I'll paraphrase, but he said, attention slips away from sculpture like water off a duck's back. And it's true that most sculpture in the public realm exists because it's on the threshold of invisibility. Something like White Reed's House clearly was not. Were we to propose a follow-up to White Reed's House now, for sure, we would probably secure permission just because of her status, mm-hmm, and the notoriety of that piece and her status as an artist. But if we were proposing something where there wasn't a kind of set of references, as there wasn't for House when we proposed, it would still be difficult.
Mm-hmm. Question?
Like Christo's Gates, did it change the economy within that?
I think there were a few local cafe owners who were very happy about it. There is a designed economy around the whole operation. It's constructed, and it's actually sold as an economic stimulus to its particular... I mean, I guess you're referring to, the New York,
in a way?
The New York thing. No, this wasn't. I mean, firstly, our PR strategy was entirely, totally the opposite of Christo's. In a sense, it was one of silence and just allowing this thing to happen. Whereas with Christo, I guess people were booking up to come to New York several months in advance.
Well, they waited 20 years, was it? Or something like that. Are there other questions in the audience before we move on to the next project? Okay. Oh, Robert.
Actually, he did. Not surprisingly, Saatchi was one of, I think, two or three people who made inquiries. It was a conceptual decision that this work would have a limited life.
Sort of the cherry blossom thing would be about intransience?
Yes. And that it would remain in memory. I think there was also a practical consideration that, that even after, you know, after its 3 months there, and you will have noticed, it had begun to get quite graffitied, to get sort of marked up in a lot of ways. And it was sort of gradually losing its otherness. There was this kind of real sense that it was like a ghost in its situation. And the more it became graffitied and marked up, the more it was becoming a bit like a piece of urban archaeology anyway. Now, if it had been very sensitively sort of uprooted and placed, let's say, in the Tate or whatever, I think it would have been okay, but I'm not sure it would have performed as a sculpture in quite the same way as ghosts do, or the bookcases or whatever there. You know, it was much rougher as a piece, and well, who knows, because we're never able to judge that. But I think really the answer to the question, it was the conceptualizing of the work by Rachel Madrid with Art Angel was that it would, you know, have a limited life.
What money is behind the plinth?
That's a mixture of local government money from the Mayor of London, and private money. When Rachel White Reid did her cast of the plinth, that was actually primarily paid for by the sale of maquettes of the plinth before.
And all the other objects there, do they wind up in someone's collection?
All the other...
From
I should explain. There's in Trafalgar Square in London, there are four plinths in the four corners of the square. Three of them have Victorian statues of generals or politicians, and one of them never had a statue put on top of it. And several years ago, a small group of which I was a member persuaded the local the council that they should run a program of temporary projects on that plinth. They go to different places, or none, depending on again how they can be moved. But I think the present sculpture is by Mark Quinn, which is one of these marble sculptures of a deformed woman,
deformed pregnant
woman. Thank you. And I'm pretty sure that exists in more than one edition, and I don't know where it's gone to, but I think it has been sold on. Shall we move on?
Yeah. I'm supposed to be the timekeeper, and I'm doing a very poor job. So
okay.
You have to move on. Gregor Schneider.
This is... kind of wanted to talk about Schneider's piece, because although... I mean, it's almost the polar opposite of the White Reid work, in the sense that White Reid's sculpture was pure... well, firstly, they were located in very, very similar kinds of streets. This is a street called Walden Street in East London, probably 50 minutes walk away from where House was made. And where White Reid's sculpture, in a way, was actually a kind of contemporary equivalent of a Victorian sculpture. And it was purely about exterior surface. You had no access to the interior at all. By contrast, Gregor Schneider's project, called Die Familie Schneider, was all purely interior. What I will do is I'll just describe to you how you experience the project. And it started off by you coming to collect a key at a small office down the road, then walking up Walden Street. In fact, there would be two of you. One of you would have a key to number 14 Walden Street, and your companion would have a key to number 16 Walden Street. And you'd been instructed to go into the houses simultaneously, one per house, and to spend up to 10 minutes in that house, then to come out, and then to exchange keys and go into the other house. So when you walked into these houses, you just walked into what appeared to be a fairly banal, depressed staircase, or entrance hallway. And then you came into a small kitchen next door to be surprised by the fact that you'd assumed you were on your own, and you discovered that you were not alone, and that the there were people in the houses, people who resolutely refused to acknowledge your presence in any way. It was an immediate temptation to say hello or try and engage them in conversation, but you got nothing back. It was as if they were in a parallel time zone. And you just worked your way through the various rooms of this house, fairly sparsely detailed. Actually, one thing you were aware of was that the rooms were uncomfortably small. Again, this was a Victorian terraced house. It was small anyway, but something that Schneider had done was to lower all of the ceilings and build into the walls to compress the space even more. But not so you could actually notice it, just so you could feel it. And then you heard a sound upstairs. You had a choice, actually, of going downstairs into a basement or upstairs onto the first floor, where there was a sound of water running. Very tentatively, most people would ease open. You had to all open doors to every room, open the door and come into the bathroom and look round, where you saw a figure of a naked, middle-aged man masturbating in the shower. Obviously, most people didn't spend very long in the room. You came out, opened another door into the bedroom. I should say there were no windows on the top floor at all. So both in the bathroom and in the bedroom, indeed the space outside, there was an increasing sense of claustrophobia. There was a garbage bag on to the side of a bed, which was covered with a very nasty kind of cheap white carpet. And as you made your way around the bed, if you did, you noticed that there was legs sticking out from under the bag. So it was, and it looked like, and you went very close, you could see there was someone breathing under the bag. It was almost certainly a small person, like a teenage son. You know, at this point, if your mind was in gear at all, you'd begin to try and construct what was going on between these different sort of atomized parts of a family, all one on their own in these different rooms, and thinking this appeared to be the teenage son or daughter of the man upstairs and the woman washing dishes, obsessively cleaning. The woman was obsessively cleaning. The man was obsessively doing something else. Whatever. You went downstairs into the basement. Again, there were a small configuration of very, very claustrophobic rooms. This was almost like a what we call a pantry, which had nothing in it except this very sad configuration of things which may have been for a child's party or something like that. So all the time you had two different impulses. One was feeling repulsed. It's kind of a basic desire to get out of this house. And the other one was to see how far you could go through. I think one of the things that Schneider is particularly interesting is this heightening of your own existential condition as you observe or participate. So you walk through the rooms of his work, which also are in a way the rooms of his mind. So after 10 minutes, you came out of the house, huge sense of relief, saw your friend, and swapped the keys, and probably didn't say very much. Some people obviously only spend a couple of minutes in the house. One or two people only got as far as the front hallway and came out again. But anyway, most people were willing to go back into the second house, where you encountered a very similar hallway. And as you worked your way through, you found that to a degree that was extremely troubling, everything was the same, that the whole experience was doubled. The woman washing dishes looked to be exactly the same as the woman in the other room. I mean, was someone playing tricks? Had they suddenly moved from one room in one house to another? Well, it appeared that way, but obviously it was impossible because, you know, your companion was having the same experience in the other house. And this doubling continued all the way through. You almost felt like you were a ghost, kind of going through, you know, completely, you were watching yourself go through the second house. There you are. A similar man again. And they were, of course, in fact, identical twins. So all of the performers in, and actually one, I think, amongst the many very difficult tasks I've been given by artists with Art Angel. Gregor's proposal that he wanted middle-aged men, identical middle-aged men, to sort of masturbate in identical shower rooms was one of the most difficult. Anyway, we did find the Johnson twins, who were failed stand-up comedians, and after a job, and actually they performed. I mean, it was an unbelievably psychologically demanding job for them to take on, but they did do it. And so there we are. It's a completely doubled experience of what became known as Schneider's twin houses. So whilst White Reed's project, you know, down the road, 10 years earlier, had on occasions towards the end of its life had, you know, hundreds, if not sometimes thousands of people sort of mobbing it and creating this sort of this kind of crowd around the sculpture, Schneider's work could only ever be experienced by one person at a time or two people in parallel. So I think it's quite an interesting counterpoint when people talk about public art. Well, this was about as intensely private and as intense as an experience, I think, as an artwork could be.
It's interesting that for all the differences, they do share some interesting links. Obviously, the house as the starting point of the work. And thinking about just the topic of privacy comes into both of them. I mean, with Rachel, you imagine who did live there, or the history of that place, and the sort of sense of privacy emanating from it as an object. But also, Rachel's is more explicitly working with the language of the monument or the memorial. But I think it's perhaps interesting to think about Gregor's piece as a kind of memorial also, because of the remove that you have as a viewer, the way that you're given access to this space, but then you're not allowed to interact with these people. They become ghost-like. You said that you felt ghost-like experiencing it. And that's a kind of sensibility that I think is common to a memorial. So that might be something. Did you ever think of it that way?
Not specifically as a memorial, but I think both projects tapped into this, the idea of the uncanny, mm-hmm. or the... Yeah, sorry.
How did the public get access?
They booked.
Pardon?
They booked.
Oh, yeah, they
had to make appointments because, you know, to try and avoid some huge queue forming.
Was there a big turnout?
It was booked out within... Oh, it had like a four-month run. It was booked out within about 3 weeks. Because word of mouth was so strong. I'm sorry, just going back to that issue about the uncanny, you know, Freud's theory of the unheimlich, and the idea of you know, what is repressed mm-hmm. In sort of everyday situations or objects always returning. And I think clearly we don't quite know the degree of repression that Schneider was operating on, but I think that idea of the uncanny does link the two quite closely.
And what was the public and critical response to the Schneider piece?
Actually, I have to say that the critical response was extraordinarily strong. I mean, strong in a very engaged way, that had recognised that that this was quite a lot of artists who somehow play with these kinds of situations, but Schneider's engagement was on a completely other register. Mm-hmm. And
do you want to mention the piece that he become known for prior to you working with him? Because I think it speaks to the sort of obsessive and immense detail to this artist.
I mean, his life work has been working for, I think now some 15 years, on his parents' house in a small provincial town in the Rhine called Reit, near Mönchengladbach. And it's called the Tutushaus, which some of you may have seen was reassembled in the German pavilion in the Venice Biennale about 5 years ago. And, you know, he just built rooms and more rooms into this house sort of obsessively over 15 years. The project we did with Schneider was sort of different in two ways. Actually, it was the first time he'd really stepped outside of his specifically German context mm-hmm. And somehow managed to quite quickly absorb the vernacular details of that part of London to be able to replicate it in a very convincing way. And also the first time he'd really had one of his rooms or his projects inhabited by people other than the spectator, the viewer. I mean, I hesitate to use the word performers, because I think actually what was so shocking to most people was that it really did not feel like a performance at all. It just felt like people in the house, which made you feel that you should not be there.
Oh. Would you talk a little bit about how it was that you invited him to work with you? Did you have a preset idea, or did it just really get thread of dialogue?
Very, very rarely is a preset idea, except that you know, we're trying to offer an artist an opportunity to do something which really counts for them, which really is a significant development in their work, and perhaps an opportunity to do something which other, which they might not be able to realize otherwise. It was difficult, but it is difficult sometimes for artists to be offered such an open brief. You know, actually, it can be easier if you point an artist to a space and say, What can you do with that? And it can be very difficult for an artist whose work is so immersed in their own particular experience. I mean, in Schneider's case, both his own personal family life and his hometown. I mean, his work had really never really travelled beyond that before. So it took a number of visits for him in London, a number of visits to London by him. And he gradually, you know, elaborated this idea, which in a way is has been latent in other works. He's always been interested in the idea of doubling, and he's created a number of double rooms before. So I guess he just extrapolated from that the idea of double houses with double families.
I think we better move on to our last project because I realize it's 8:15.
Is it? Would you want to do the last project or?
Yeah, I do.
Okay. All right. Well, this one you're more familiar with because part of it's showing next door, so I'll try and be very brief. But Francis Alice, as an artist who I think has As you mentioned, I mean, some of the projects that we initiate have a very, very long gestation period. So I think I first approached Francis in the last century. And we only finally managed to do a project. He has a fantastic capacity to defer decision-making, I have to say. So he managed to do that for several years by making the project more and more complicated until, and I'm delighted, it was such a complex and multifaceted and entangled project, which became Seven Walks. You know, like Schneider and White Reed, it's a project made in London on one level about London. And I think what we see a lot with the artists is that we're not inviting artists to somehow... It would be absurd to be expecting artists to change their working approaches, their vocabularies, their ideas. What we're sort of asking them is to try and find a way in which those can be applied and extended in a particularly interesting way in confrontation with aspects of, you know, the city, if you like, the material of the city. Alice, as you probably know, is a great walker, so he spent many weeks walking through London, trying to, as it were, find the kind of keys or the particular little details or incidents that would spark him off. And one of the things he did a lot in the early time was to start to drum on the railings of Georgian London. That's the, you know, the grander parts of London, which are, he noticed that as people do notice things about your own city you don't see yourself, that railings in London are more or less ubiquitous compared with other cities, and they do denote a particular kind of relationship between property and the public realm, private property and the public realm. So one of the films, he made several films actually simply called Railings, where he drummed on railings and buildings of different parts of London. And I have to say, actually, the whole of the project, or large parts of the project, were conceived fundamentally as being more musical. So, like the Guards piece, on one level, was inspired not so much by a kind of minimal sculpture, as it looks like, but more by the sort of music of, or the contemporary modern music of Ligeti or Steve Reich or whatever. So there were seven projects which constituted the final installation. This is one called Walking a Painting, and this is Francis Alice himself holding a painting in the subway. And every day, this painting went on a walk of its own. So this is how it was displayed in the installation in London last fall. And it was a painting of people who appeared to be commuters of one kind or other, walking on the street. And each night,
Francis's painting?
It was a painting by Francis. It was always remained wrapped up. And each night, a member of the public, someone like one of you, would sign up to take the painting home with you for the night. And we asked simply that we were provided with a photograph of what was done with the painting. And it went to all sorts of different places, and then was returned the following morning in time for the exhibition to open. So it was a kind of, the idea of kind of mobility or circulation of ideas and images is critical in Francis' work. So this was just a kind of a symbol of that sort of interest. He picked up on the fact that London is probably the most surveyed city in the world. Surveillance cameras are, they're prevalent in all of our cities, but they're absolutely ubiquitous in London. And he lives in Mexico City, and Mexico City doesn't have this ubiquitous presence of CCTV cameras, because, as he said, they would simply be stolen. The Londoners have accepted the fact that they are basically watched over for a considerable amount of their time. And he originally wanted to make the Guards film, showing out there, on security, filmed only by security cameras, as a kind of anonymous sort of filmmaking. And we tried to secure permission. We tried to work out whether we could get footage from the hundreds of CCTV cameras around the City of London to make the film, and discovered that although you have a right, you have a right to ask a bank or an office to look at the material if you think you've been filmed on it, you don't have a right to get a copy of it. So that proved to be impossible. So we kind of moved sideways with the idea of making a film with surveillance or security cameras inside a building. And we picked up on the phenomenon of the urban fox. In London, in the last 20 years or so, foxes have come in from the country and started to inhabit the city. I don't know, does that happen in... You've got urban foxes in... No? Yes?
Wolf problems,
Washington? Possums. Right. Anyway, so it's... We could have possibly, but well, then you would have. It was complicated because to have done that, we would then have had to have guided the route of the soldiers in the City of London. We didn't do that, so. Well, then, yeah, we would have needed to install literally hundreds, if not thousands, of cameras. So it got to the point of being almost totally impractical. So we decided to work with a fox, and we secured permission for the fox to spend a night wandering through the galleries of the National Portrait Gallery in London, being filmed by the surveillance cameras in the galleries. And so the fox just spent several hours inspecting portraits of these kind of the great and the good of British history, many of whom would, of course, spend their leisure time hunting foxes. There he is with Queen Elizabeth. And that material was edited into two different films. One was, it was then replayed in the National Portrait Gallery as if it was a security or a CCTV bank. And this was installed there for last fall. We would just be able to track the movements of the fox through the gallery. And then it was also shown in the other building where we presented the guards film and the railings film and some other material. And the guards, I don't really need to... Oh, this is what happened last time. There sort of seems a resistance to move.
To not moving forward?
I think you have to take that one out.
While we're waiting, was there ever a question about inhumane treatment of the animal?
Actually, he was... no, he was... he was a professional. We hired the fox.
It's called
Bandit, from a company that would hire out animals for advertising shoots.
And he didn't mind the art.
We were assured. He came with a handler, and he'd been well fed before. And we were assured that actually that he would be to just furtively, be like a fox and just rush around sort of, along the walls and sort of curl up in quiet places. And that's what he did. I have to say it was a particular act of courage from the director of the National Portrait Gallery. But fortunately, he's one of my trustees. So... Of the fox and the...
Yes.
Well, I would say that the initial idea was effectively about the ubiquity of surveillance. I think he was just then very interested in the fact that the fox is a kind of urban myth, that everyone talks about it, you occasionally see them. And, you know, that to, as it were, create a scenario which was sufficiently plausible that people might believe that it had happened for real, that a fox could have actually somehow penetrated the security of the National Portrait Gallery. And I think what Francis was interested in doing was actually creating his own kind of little urban myth. It would be the story of the fox in the gallery at night. And the way that we played the publicity for that was to offer it as a news story first. So in like the Times and the Guardian, there was this image of the fox appearing at night, and then it was broadcast on television again as well. So
hasn't Francis
done kind of interested in the idea of rumor, as this sort of as something which people hear about, and you know then circulates and maybe slightly changes form, or slightly changes the idea. So I guess the fox idea for him was to trying to create a sort of rumor in the city. I think the other thing is that in a way, I mean, I also interpret the fox as being the fox is an interloper in this situation, a little bit like I think Francis himself thought of himself as being an interloper in the city. So on one level, I think the fox is a kind of surrogate for Francis himself as a sort of as a sort of furtive presence in the city.
And he's used other animals as surrogates for himself in Venice. I don't remember
he used a peacock to represent himself in the Venice Biennale.
So he would send the peacock to events where he was supposed to be to stand in for him. But also, wasn't he interested in the way that, looking more historically, the way that animals were kind of integrated into life in a way that has stopped, so that you might see, I know in the book there's a painting, I can't remember who it is, in which animals were actually in the museum with people.
Yeah, I think that's a Seine-Redam painting of an interior of a church, which just has a little dog
in
the corner. But actually, Francis Alice studied architecture, and he spent some time in Italy, and his thesis was about the presence of animals within the kind of pre-Renaissance city, and then what happened in the as cities, as the structure and the management of cities was rationalized during the Renaissance, somehow animals became sort of beyond the pale. So animals were kind of relocated from being part of everyday life to being sort of outside the city walls. So you know, he tracked that. I mean, I think there was maybe those Uccello paintings, was that?
Mm-hmm.
There was Uccello paintings,
right,
too. So he does have a particular interest with the relationship of animals to the city.
And I think your comment, part of what you just said, is also quite important for Francis, is that all of his walks and all of... And in the case of the projects that he did with you, his walks have kind of moved in interesting ways beyond just him as a singular figure moving around the city, but in whatever form they're taking now, these walks are really a study, in some sense, of the modern city, a way to try to understand something that's quite complicated. And in some sense, I think with an architectural background, he's really trying to almost map, in some ways, the way that the city has changed over time. And I think that has interesting links to previous practices, both in literature and art and theory, the city really as his site of all of his work.
Yeah, I mean, although I think it's interesting you mentioned literature, because he's, you know, there are clear precedents in relation to certain artists from the 60s and 70s doing sort of walking works like Acconci or whatever. But I tend to think of him much more as an artist in the line of Borges or Calvino or someone like that, who's kind of creating sort of rather kind of fables, if you like, or sort of short stories, which somehow aren't really explained.
Mm-hmm. And a lot is left to chance.
A lot is left for people to, I mean, you know, interpret them as they wish. But if you like, just like Calvino wrote, you know, it's invisible. You know, cities are just many, many different ways of describing Venice. I think, you know, that's what Alice has done, in a sense, in Mexico City, where most of his work is made. And actually, by investing so much time making this project in London, you know, made something which had a similar kind of status. I mean, there's these sort of little fables. I mean, what's really going on in the Guards film? Why? No one's explaining that. Sorry.
What nationality is he?
He's Belgian.
Was he born in the city or out in the country?
He lived out in the country, actually. I think he was born in Antwerp. But I know that he spent much of his time living in... His father was, I think, a judge. He lived out there. You look like that explains something to you, the fact that he's born in Antwerp.
Well, I just wanted to sort of pilgrimage to Antwerp, but it's not... Yes, it's a special city that's very much steeped in, you know, back to the 1100s, and it's... Yeah. Okay, so it seems to make...
And I think there's a relationship somewhere in his work to Marcel Broders, too. Mm. And this kind of... It is a sort of critique, if you like, of the experience of empire, which of course was extremely strong both in Belgium and in Britain. And I think, you know, actually when one looks at the various components of Seven Walks together, you realise in a rather kind of subtle and elliptical way he's really trying to get under the skin of as it were, the long shadow that empire has, you know, cast over contemporary London, has over Belgium today.